So Armeran will discuss this issue of registries.
So I actually have prepared a whole slide set, but I actually think that we need to get away because a lot of what we have already discussed is on this on these slide sets about the fact that we have a just so you know what my disclosures are. That's important, but really very importantly, and I'm not going to go into it, but this is where we are: is that the randomized clinical trials, along with the observational registries, whether they're post-approval studies or observational registries that are looking at different therapies, I do believe that enhance our ability for evidence-based medicine. And without either one, so we could sit here and pick on randomized clinical trials as we did in the last session and observational registries, and we can find holes in both of them, but together they can complement and really do give us very, very important evidence-based medicine for which hopefully we can guide our practice. The question of adoptability of what we find in clinical trials and in post-approval studies, whether they're randomized and observational, and how we adopt it into practice, I think is another one. I think a very, very important point of discussion for this group, such that the applicability of what it is that we do is very much limited and dependent on the limitations of both the randomized trials that may not represent the population and the observational registries for which we do not pick up the confounding information and the quality of the data that goes into it. So I'm always coming back to our device at the FDA, and I think that the post-approval studies are a fantastic thing. It helps address your problems, Rita, that you know, there's just not enough. The patients are small. We're not really picking the number of patients are small. We're not picking up the important, perhaps some rare important signals. These are implantable devices that stay in these patients forever. So the post-approval studies try to answer some of those questions and hopefully give some confidence to all of us that the safety is continued to be observed with much larger numbers of patients. But my issue with the post-approval studies is exactly what Ileana just brought up. Yes, it's fantastic that we're able to see 8,000 plus patients in the Intermax study, but what's the quality of the data that we're receiving in these registries? And these are very, very busy centers, and we know, all of us know, that even in NCDR registries and also with the TAVR registries, with these extremely busy centers, that the quality of the data that you're receiving. So you're basically come back to the one endpoint that we could collect, and this is kind of rude and crude, but it's body counts at the end of the day. It's the deaths that are really are the hard endpoint that we could, with some level of confidence, collect. And so I think it comes back to us, and our discussion points are how can we complement these and make best use of the observational post-approval studies to enhance what goes on in the randomized clinical trial. And it does come back, again, to whether or not you like it or not, both Rita and Ileana, it's really hard to get patients on absolutely optimal medical therapy because much of what the doctors do, at the end of the day, the patients are the reservoir, if you will, or the controlling factor. If they are not taking their medication and they're not compliant, you end up with a difficult situation, and you're not able to actually show those differences. So going back to this to our discussion elements and post-approval studies, and perhaps we could begin our discussion. And I have a lot of similar slides that actually Stuart presented. And I do want to say that randomized trials are also problematic. They're important disadvantages because there are certain hypotheses that we can't randomize. And one of the biggest ones that we're always concerned about is this impact of bleeding on outcomes. We really just can't really come up and basically say, is there really an association or is it a causal relationship? And that becomes very, very difficult. And then when randomized trials take over 35,000 patients screened and only a tenth of those patients are randomized, you come back and say, is this really representative of what goes on? So then we have the post-approval studies. And of course, we talked about all the disadvantages, so I'm not going to go over those. We go over the observational, and these unmeasured confounders, even in the post-approval studies, makes it extremely difficult for us to then say, are we seeing a signal associated with the fact that there are unmeasured confounders, and we can't make an important comparative. And we talked about, you saw these data, and I'm not going to go through this, but we've all seen registries that have shown, and two New England, and John, this is for you, two New England Journal big registries, Ontario Registry and SCAR Registry, where we have completely opposite results. One showing a 3-year mortality increase with DES, and one showing a 30% decrease with DES, and Stuart went through the very, very important limitations of registries. So just to kind of go back and now say, how do we use our post-approval registries to complement our randomized clinical trials, and then, of course, to give some level of confidence that device safety and efficacy is actually applicable to the generalized population. But I think it's really important to say that we cannot use these for comparative effectiveness analysis, and that's something that gets done over and over again, and we need to really continue to stay in the realm of randomized clinical trials that are well-powered. Thank you for your attention.
Are there questions?
Alphonse Vincent, Medtronic. I would like to add something to that, because I think that we get a little bit of discussion between whether we should do a kind of a randomized trial or a registry, and I think it's very important to emphasize that it's both. You need both. And one comment that was made about lead issues in the past, it is important to realize that none of the lead issues that exist at the moment would have been captured by a randomized trial, because those trials are too small, and normally they are short-term. So it's very important to do the post-market surveillance in a very proper way, and I agree that sometimes the registries are not done in a proper way, but I think that's something we should push for, and we should take care that we get very reliable data from the real world, because those patients are different, and especially the long-term aspects is something that we should not forget about in medical devices. It may be different in drugs, probably you have less long-term effects that you may encounter, but I think especially with the medical devices, it is a lot of mechanical stuff that's in there, and that may break, or you may get issues on the long term.
I have a question myself, and it's related to how can you reduce selection bias for registries? In other words, I imagine the Intramax, due to the small population of patients, the fact that it's such an expensive device, you're almost obliged to enter the patient in Intramax. But how can you do that with much more common devices like ICDs, for instance? How can you somehow guarantee that the population of patients that is entering a registry is representative of the overall population? How can you increase that likelihood, at least?
Well, one answer to that, at least in the United States, is that CMS, our sister organization in the Health and Human Services, at least for the over 65 population, has required participation in clinical registries as part and parcel of their reimbursement. True, that doesn't help for those under 65, but it is one answer.
And some of the registries, like the NCDR registry, which are adopted by the societies, do put pressure especially on the academic medical centers to enroll the patients and to enter. And I think sort of the board has enough of a variety of us that we can do that. There'll be smaller hospitals that escape us. I mean, it's going to happen. But I think for the bulk, it's there.
Right. Some payers have taken it up by requiring registry participation in order to be a center of excellence, and there's differential reimbursement. So that's for the under 65, although it's not 100%.
These things you're mentioning assure that the registry is representative, but it doesn't do anything at all about bias, because bias is treatment selection.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps to add another point, with the difficulty of registries to capture the comorbidities, from my point of view, because in the randomized control trials, we have very clear defined populations. We exclude the renal insufficiency, we exclude the pulmonary dysfunction, and in reality, we have these three comorbidities being very present, and the question is, if in a comorbid population, the signal will still be as strong, and that's why I think, but that's a difficulty really to capture that in a good way with a good quality in these post-marketing studies.
Well, at least in the FDA post-marketing studies, we insist on all comers and consecutive enrollment, so that does help. So we get not only the on-label participation of patients, but also the broader clinical use in the community.
The Intermax does capture the bulk of things like bleeding and stroke rates. How much renal failure we capture, I'm not sure. And some of these patients have so many events, if they're really sick, that you may capture one, but you miss the second one, and you miss the third one, then you capture maybe the fourth one. And we had a long discussion about how can we get these sites, for example, to take the health status questionnaires seriously, rather than in the past this has been fluff in the trials, and oh well, you know, the coordinator isn't there that day, so we're not going to do the health status assessment, making it as critically important. And we have done this at FDA, really advising the companies the trial conduct is to be as rigorous as the recruitment is, the collection of the data.
And I think we should also reconsider whether we should have as much exclusion criteria as we currently tend to do for randomized trials, because we often have upper age cutoffs, we have comorbidity exclusions, and as you point out, as soon as the drug or device is approved, our patients have all these different ages and they have all these comorbidities, and so I think it would be better for randomized trials to not have so many exclusions.
Reid, I would agree, and the approach we've been taking, short of all comers for some of our interventional cardiology trials, is something we've called more comers, to try to broaden out the base so that they are more representative, but at the end of the day still have a coherent data set that we can interpret.
So thank you. I think we should.